Case number 2011-41080, Roland Palacios v. Rick Thaler. You may. Thank you.
Irma Sahinez for the appellant, Roland Palacios. Everything that could go wrong with the case, it appears, has gone wrong with my case, Your Honor. I think you've probably read that on April 5th of 2012, I was given a notice to come and argue before this court on equitable tolling of the 2244 statute for the 28 U.S.C. 2254 that I had filed. Mr. Sullivan replaces the two prior attorney generals on the case. First it was Mr. Ensminger, and then Jackson, and then Mr. Sullivan. And I think on May 25th, he files a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction for the first time. It's never brought up in any briefing whatsoever. So that on May 25th, I was ordered by this court to file an answer, and that was the Memorial Day weekend. It was, I tried to do as much as I could, considering that I was alone and filed a response, Your Honor. And I did file a response. It is not an adequate response, I feel, but that's all I have. If I may proceed then on the motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, on the procedural points that I want to make, because I'm going to have to ask the court for equity on this issue as I am on the tolling of the 2244, if I may.
Counsel, I wanted to let you know that we're aware that you had very little time because of the tardiness of the state bringing this to our attention. And if you believe that after oral argument that you need to file a 28J, it could even be over the page guidelines for the 28J, but in that format on any of these issues that were raised so tardily,
Yes. Then
you may do so, because I know that you were under pressure on the Memorial Day weekend as a result of this very lately raised issue, and I don't want you to be prejudiced in that way. You know, we have to address jurisdiction. Okay. Because it's jurisdiction.
Yes.
We can't ignore it and say, well, it's waived because it's jurisdiction. But we want you to have an adequate opportunity so you can have, 2 weeks after argument to file a 28J on anything else that you think of regarding the jurisdiction point. Okay?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, thank you, because I've had about a total of 12 days on this issue. Your Honor,
Could you avoid it just by withdrawing the motion? I'm not saying you want to lose that motion, but if you just withdrew your motion or dismissed it, then the Rule 4 issue would go away, or am I wrong?
If I filed my motion, it was not my motion.
Right? That's the motion that's pending in the district court.
The motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, Mr. Sullivan's motion.
No, that's his motion in front of us.
Yes.
But it's predicated on a motion that's pending in the district court, right?
I asked my client to dismiss it.
Oh.
But
doesn't
it was too late prior to coming here. It is not easy discussing.
I know. Okay.
But that's another alternative for you.
Yes.
And your client to consider what's in your client's best interest, which I think is Judge Higginson's drawing to your attention.
Sure.
That may be something your client considers, but of course you and your client have to make the best decision that y'all believe is strategic and appropriate and legal.
That's correct. And I have asked through his wife.
Yeah.
I have asked through his wife on telephone to please have him consider it, but it was too late before I took a plane over here.
My apprehension is there are some really tricky issues in the merits side.
Right.
And obviously we will have to get our own jurisdiction correct.
Yes.
You don't have that much time. You do whatever you want to do or my colleagues ask you to do, but I'd almost prefer you to move to your merits issues, because it's going to come back to us no matter what relatively soon, my guess is.
Well, yes. The judicial economy issue is what I would like to in a little while discuss. But if I may then proceed on some. It, it, for my argument that I'm going to make, Your Honor, for good cause, that you, Mr. Sullivan is asking for dismissal, which is a very harsh remedy, and I'm going to have to ask for something else from this court. So if I may, Your Honor, a 2254 was filed by me on February 25th, 2011. I was hired February 18th, 2011. I filed it as soon as I could, Your Honor. A motion for summary judgment was filed by Mr. Ensminger, Attorney General of Texas. A summary judgment order issued on September 20th, 2011. And unbeknown to me, the district judge, who, by the way, had only been sworn in the month before, Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos, She signed a summary judgment order on September 20th, 2011, but then never signed a dismissal order, unbeknownst to me. In any event, you know, I was on a case for not filing. I was on a case where a man was prejudiced by his attorney not filing his state habeas. So here I was in a predicament. So I filed my notice of appeal right away, 10 days later. I didn't wait any longer. I filed it on September 30th, 2011. The state district court provided, I'm sorry, a CD to you of the record by October 14, 2011. I was ordered at that time to please file a petition for certificate of appealability, and I did, and it was filed. I asked for one extension. It was filed on December 27th.
Counsel, let me stop you. Aren't we here today not necessarily to evaluate your handling of the case? We're here to evaluate, as I appreciate, the issues in this case, whether your client acted with reasonable diligence. I mean, the record suggests that he hired a lawyer. I don't think there's a dispute that the lawyer was not responsible. He certainly would, some would argue, abandoned the case. But there are other indications in the record that your client could have and eventually did, in fact, on his own, pursue his claims. And so it seems to me the issue is knowing that he could have pursued his claims on his own in pro se filings, which he eventually did, why didn't he do that much, much earlier on in the process?
The merits of the equitable tolling, not the jurisdiction
right.
problem.
Right. We've moved beyond.
Okay, so who do I, what, do I consider a jurisdiction issue?
No, Your Honor, I mean, ma'am, counsel.
Yes.
Can you address Judge Jackson's question, please?
Yes, I will. Your Honor, the equitable tolling is based on Holland v. Florida. Mr. Holland, in that case, was diligent, even though the district court said he wasn't diligent. He wasn't because he didn't ask for outside help. The Supreme Court in Holland v. Florida said this man was diligent because in the end, he was forced to file his own pro se habeas, even though it was late. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals said, we're not going to toll his limitations because his attorney was negligent. But you need more than gross negligence. You need fraud, dishonesty, mental impairment on behalf of the attorney. The Supreme Court said in Holland v. Florida, no, that is a rigid approach that is not needed in this case. All you need is for an attorney to not provide counsel that is within professional, did not exercise professional care.
Let's say you're right on Holland.
Yes.
And let's say the district court here made a mistake.
They made a mistake.
Made a mistake.
Because
looking
they used
for counsel,
the wrong
wait a second.
Standard.
Listen to my question.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the district court made a mistake. There was an extraordinary circumstance. The lawyer abandoned your client.
Yes.
But you still have to show that your client on his own exercised reasonable diligence. And when I read the district court order, at least at the end, I think it's record page 1038, the district court said your client had actually given a fully written writ to his lawyer. So when the lawyer is discharged, and the time hasn't yet elapsed, why isn't your client able to file the writ he'd already written in time?
Your Honor, the court in Holland reviewed The same thing, the same facts. Mr. Holland's attorney took 312 days. The Holland court said this man was diligent. He was diligent because he wrote letters to Collins. He was diligent even though no replies came, right? The same thing of my client. The court said, well, when he didn't answer you, why didn't you do something? Holland faced the same thing from Collins. Collins never replied.
Right. Collins?
Right.
Yeah.
And yet the court, Holland said, that is due diligence. The Holland court said, writing him letters, telling him, feeding his own attorney, the statute of limitations. My client did the same thing. That is diligence. That's what the Holland court used as an example of diligence. Feeding Collins information on the statute of limitations. Then waiting 5 months. Mr. Holland waited 5 months before Collins even answered the letter telling him, oh, your habeas is denied. 4 weeks after he is denied, Holland is still writing another letter to Collins asking for an update. 9 days after sending that last letter, Holland finds out, 5 weeks earlier, the mandate issued. And then he files his own pro se habeas. The court said that was due diligence, filing your state, your federal habeas. In that case, it was federal habeas. Mm-hmm. Filing your pro se habeas, and they didn't hold it against him. They didn't say, well, you could have filed it before. They could have said, it's not due diligence. You had, in the end, you filed your own pro se. Why didn't you do it 5 months ago? The court didn't say that. The judge was very, in fact, in one of their opinions, one of the concurring judges said, you know, you cannot hold the principal liable for what a rogue agent does. You can't say, well, the principal had control of his destiny the whole time. Why didn't he do something? That's what the Holland court said. You cannot hold him liable. In fact, the principal has a lawsuit against the agent for damages. The same thing with Mr. Holland.
Well, let me interrupt you, counsel. And I would just tell you what troubles me about this and why I believe it's a very serious question here, whether your client exercised reasonable diligence. There are several time frames here, some of which may provide some justification, some of which may not. But I've got the fact that he waited a period of time, before even hiring a lawyer, right?
Sure. You know.
Oh, wait, let me finish now. So he waits a period of time before he even retains counsel.
Yes.
But then he begins to provide information, and his wife gets involved. Ms. Cortez gets involved, and at least for a period of time, she placed a number of phone calls. But then all of a sudden, she stops even trying to reach out to Mr. McMaines. And then most relevant to me is that there was a 13-day period from the time he fired Mr. McMaines to the time within which he could file before the deadline.
Yes.
And nothing happened within that 13. In other words, to me, he's shown the capacity to move forward on this thing. He's shown the capacity to draft everything he needs to do, as Judge Higginson pointed out, pretty much giving Mr. McMaines everything he needs to file. And yet he waits, in fact, does nothing within this 13-day
sure.
period. But beyond that, when the petitioner's documents are finally returned to him, to his wife at least, he still waits well over a month before he files anything.
Yeah.
How could I conclude that he acted with diligence?
And Holland did the same thing, and the court didn't strike him for that. All right. But let me tell you, yes, Ms. Jackson wrote in her brief, Holland had a court-appointed attorney. All right. My client had filed a PDR and had pro se, and he had messed it up, and it was dismissed by the state court. He didn't feel confident. The record shows that my client was mentally ill.
But he did file a grievance.
Okay.
He filed
yes.
a grievance.
That's also part of due diligence. Mr. Holland filed a grievance also. All right. It took him, and Ms. Jackson criticizes him for taking 9 months. Your Honor, what prisoner? The record shows he was indigent. This guy was broke. He had no family until he married Mrs. Palacios. Yes, it took him 9 months to come up with $2,000. And my client is now at the Connolly unit. He was at Polonsky. That's the death chamber unit. What kind of communication do you think he is allowed to, on the outside, to go out to help himself? He took 9 months to come up with $2,000 and then hires McMaines. But he tells him right away, sir, you have, 5 months to file my habeas. He feeds him the statute of limitations. Sir, you must file my habeas, because even though there is no limitations in the state court, there is in federal court. And when you file my state habeas, you told the federal. He fed him just like Holland fed Collins.
Counsel, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Yes. All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, James P. Sullivan for the director. This court lacks appellate jurisdiction because Palacios has not yet filed an effective notice of appeal according to Rule 4A4B1. His notice of appeal has been suspended by his post-judgment motion, which is still pending in the district court. So this court should dismiss the appeal for want of jurisdiction and signal to the district court that it needs to dispose of the post-judgment motion before anything else can happen in this case. Now, some of the concerns that have been raised from the panel this morning are certainly valid. And so before I say anything more, I want to apologize to the court on behalf of the director and the Attorney General of Texas that it has taken us so long to bring this jurisdictional problem to the court's attention. This should have been raised in our appellee's brief, which was filed almost a year ago. It was a failure in our professional obligation not to help this court discharge its own obligation under Steel Co. to police jurisdictional boundaries. I also want to apologize to my friend in opposition for ruining a holiday weekend, and we have no objection to Judge Elrod's 14 days or however much time they need to have a careful response to the jurisdictional argument that we've raised.
There's some irony that the apology gets a lot more time on an issue, and yet the underlying merits issue is there will be no more time.
Right. And, Your Honor, because it's my professional obligation to help this court police these jurisdictional boundaries, when this court set this cause for oral argument, new counsel, me, I took a look at the record, discovered the jurisdictional problem. I know that some of the panelists today are former government lawyers, so I'm sure that this will ring true for you as well. I tried to bring it to the court's attention as soon as possible so that my friend in opposition would have an opportunity to respond today at the podium. But again, I'm very sorry that it has taken us this long. It sounds like from the questions that there's not much that needs to be said about the jurisdictional issue. I'll walk through it briefly, but I want to yield back to the court as much time as I can and answer any questions that I can about equitable tolling. The problem here, the jurisdictional problem, arises under Rule 4A4B1. When Palacios filed his post-judgment motion, his Rule 59E motion to alter or amend the judgment, it suspended his notice of appeal. And of course, as the Supreme Court has said in Griggs and Torres and many other cases, the notice of appeal is a document of jurisdictional significance. And it is suspended when the post-judgment motion is filed, so that the district court retains jurisdiction and can have the last word on the points raised there. And Mr. Palacios's post-judgment motion actually raises equitable tolling issues. So it's a sensible system that allows one judge to decide the question before three judges do.
Go ahead.
I do have one question. The rule talks about the text. The rule talks about after the court enters the judgment. In this case, the notice of appeal was filed before the court entered its judgment.
Yes.
So in general, it appears that you're correct on the jurisdiction argument, that there's a technical issue with the language of the rule.
Right.
Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that Rule 4A2 fixes this technical problem. Rule 4A2 provides that if a notice of appeal is prematurely filed, that is, filed before the judgment is entered on the district court's record, then the notice of appeal relates forward and is deemed filed as of the day that the judgment is entered, but after the judgment is entered. So
it modifies the importance of the announce or enter judgment language in 4A4B1.
Yes, but only slightly. As this court said in Ross versus Marshall, the sequence of events as between the notice of appeal and the post-judgment motion doesn't really change the analysis. And again, this makes sense so that the district court has an opportunity to pass upon Palacios's arguments in his post-judgment motion before it's elevated and three judges have to look at the same problem.
Okay. I'm sorry, Judge Higginson, did you have a jurisdiction question?
Well, yeah, actually a little bit. Thank you. Because it's still pending in the district court, there's actually a unique, I'm throwing it out to you. There is an opportunity, if you agree that the reliance on Riggs is incorrect in light of Holland, there's an opportunity to have the district court focus more than it did, because when I read its actual order, it adopts the magistrate. It overrules a few objections, but it's still, in my mind, largely mistaken under its use of Riggs. So we could get a more probing inquiry into the larger issue of prevention or the preliminary question of, you see where I'm going?
I do. And I think that that's precisely why the jurisdictional scheme is constructed in the way that it is, so that the district court, I mean, it would be not a very good use of resources here for me to tell you a lot about the equitable tolling question, because I don't imagine that anything I say is going to be terribly memorable or that it'll stick with
you. No, I doubt that. I think it's a really tricky issue, but I'm wondering what Texas is going to do below, because if you stand on you should just deny it, which might seem tempting to a lower court because it's teed up in part to us.
Right.
But if Texas had the viewpoint, no, this case could get a better look in light of the confusion about Riggs.
Right. Right. And there's also now the subsequently decided cause from the Supreme Court of the United States in McQuiggins. This is a man who has raised an actual innocence challenge. And recently the Supreme Court said that there's an actual innocence exception to the statute of limitations.
Have you filed in, last question, I promise, and then I'll get on, but have you filed below saying there's never been an evidentiary hearing in this, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So obviously, if Texas were to invite one, then I'm sure the district court would take
right.
that seriously.
Well, I think that there is, it's possible that this could be dealt with without the need for that,
okay.
but now that you're telling me this, of
no,
course.
No, I'm not, obviously.
Oh, no, I mean, we, with the benefit of your wisdom on this issue, we're certainly going to evaluate those options. So we will think about that. I also want to try to answer a question that you asked my friend in opposition when she was at the podium. You asked whether if Palacios withdraws his motion, it would fix the jurisdictional problem here. And it would, but again, as Judge Elrod points out, turning back to the text, as this court said in Simmons, it will fix the problem after the district court enters an order disposing of the motion. So even after he withdraws it, the district court still has to take some step. But
you assume if you withdraw a motion, the district court would.
Yeah, it shouldn't take.
It was
right. I mean, it shouldn't.
Or, you know,
right. I'm sure that the district judge does not like getting calls from his chief judge or her chief judge, rather, about cases on the docket. And if you can get this one off because the motion has been withdrawn, then, you know, it's a volume business. We all have a lot to do. And so that could fix the problem here. The recommendation that we've made on the jurisdictional point that this court should dismiss the cause for want of jurisdiction here is based on what this court did in Simmons. Essentially,
what about Burt v. Ware, published case from 1994, we retain limited jurisdiction over the appeal except for the purposes of a limited remand to allow the district court to rule on the 59 motion.
Well, of course, Simmons couldn't have overruled that as a subsequent decision.
Right.
And so I think that the Seventh Circuit's approach here, they've basically abated appeals before. I mean, as long as this court isn't purporting to speak with force of law and issue a binding judgment, it won't be exceeding the limits of its jurisdiction. I think that the Simmons court's eagerness to dismiss the cause for want of jurisdiction was based on what the Supreme Court has said in Steele Co., And I'll paraphrase it and say it less eloquently than the Supreme Court said in Ex parte McCardle, but essentially when a federal court lacks jurisdiction, the only business that remains to be done is to announce the fact and to dismiss the cause.
But you're saying we could do exactly what we could follow the Burt v. Ware approach because it's already been briefed on the equitable tolling and...
I think that you probably could. Now, query whether you'll actually save all that much time. If we go back to the district court and the district court writes more or talks about McQuiggins or holds an evidentiary hearing, then, of course, the briefs that you have in front of you aren't going to do you very much good. But this is not a hill that I'm going to die on. I, of course, leave it in the court's hands how you want to deal with the jurisdictional problem. I've now discharged my professional obligation to alert the court. And again, I apologize to my friend in opposition and to the court that it took so long to get such a simple jurisdictional problem teed up for the court. If it sounds like the court is eager also to discuss the equitable tolling issue, and so I want to try to answer any questions that I have. I do think that Chief Judge Jackson and Judge Higginson have gone to one of the real problems here, and one of the reasons why the district court did not abuse its discretion when it held that this is not one of those rare and exceptional cases in which equitable tolling of the AEDPA's statute of limitations is in order. And the first problem, the problem that you've raised, Your Honor, is the problem of diligence. There are a number of different delays that have to be accounted for here. There's the 7-month delay, and unfortunately, again, and I apologize, our appellee's brief mistakenly calls it a 9-month gap. It was actually 7 months of time that had elapsed before a lawyer was hired. But as my friend in opposition has explained, you know, not all of us always has the money all the time to hire lawyers. But the fact remains that equitable tolling is denied even to pro se litigants who never get an attorney. And so I'm not sure that that would really excuse the 7-month delay, especially where, as Judge Higginson pointed out, Palacios is quite able to protect his own rights in court. In addition to page 1038 of the Record on Appeal, Judge Higginson, there's also a letter from Palacios to Ms. Sanjinez at page 1020 of the Record on Appeal, in which he writes to his lawyer, quote, "I did the writ in here, then sent it in to him already completed." He's speaking about McMaines here. So it's difficult to understand quite what the holdup was when this was somebody who was able to draft documents and protect his
equitable
rights.
Equitable tolling, is it right to think of it as three elements? Reasonable diligence first, then is there an extraordinary intervening event third that prevented him? And if so, if that's the way to think of it schematically, can you cross-pollinate the first and the third?
I think that you absolutely can, and I think that that's a good way to think of it, but of course I wouldn't urge this court to disturb the numbering that the Supreme Court gave it in Holland, but I think that it's probably a helpful analytical construct. And you've put your finger on an important part of the extraordinary circumstances element that is numbered 2 in Holland and in Pace versus DiGuglielmo and Lawrence. And that is that it has to be an exceptional circumstance beyond the litigant's control that prevents them from filing. And that's another problem for Palacios in this case. This case is different from Holland versus Florida because of the nature of the relationship between the prisoner and his lawyer, and then the relationship between the prisoner and the court. As the Supreme Court made clear in Holland, the fact that that there was a court-appointed lawyer, Collins, who was representing Holland, actually stood as an obstacle to Holland's filing of documents in the courts. The federal and state courts had essentially said, we will entertain no pro se filings from this prisoner, Holland, who actually, as the Supreme Court's opinion makes quite clear, had a much better grasp of the statute of limitations under the AEDPA than the lawyer representing him. And so the fact that he had a lawyer who was negligent, who was doing a terrible job, was also standing in the way of his protecting his own rights. That prisoner had tried diligently to fire his lawyer. The state opposed him at every turn there, and the courts did not allow him to fire his lawyer. And so he was not able to protect his own rights. That stands in stark contrast to this case.
Texas isn't taking the position that if you could file a pro se brief, that will always make you ineligible for equitable tolling.
No, I don't think that it would. So, for instance, I know that this court has had cases about things like inadequate prison libraries where they've said that that's not equitable tolling, but maybe if there were a lockdown and your prison papers were taken away from you. It's not simply the fact that the prisoner could have protected himself here. It's more the absence, as you say, of things that are preventing him from filing. And here, it's also important to note the relationship between the lawyer McMaines and the prisoner Palacios. McMaines was hired to file the state habeas application, but not the federal habeas application. So that's different from Holland as well. And that matters here for the reason that Chief Judge Jackson has pointed out, and that is that even after Palacios fired McMaines, he had 13 days remaining, and a reasonably diligent litigant in that position would have done something to protect his rights in the federal court and not just in the state court. And the way he could have done that would have been to file what the Supreme Court and this court have called a protective petition under Pace versus DiGuglielmo and Rines versus Weber.
But we've specifically said you don't have to file a protective petition to get the benefit of equitable tolling in some unpublished cases.
Well, I think that
we have one that we intended to indicate you should. But
right.
Then we have some others that say you shouldn't. So I don't know that we've decided the issue that you would have to file the protective.
Well, okay, and that's fair enough, although I think that Supreme Court precedent in Holland, to the extent that it says that the prisoner has to be reasonably diligent in pursuing his rights, the rights that we're talking about here are his right to file a federal habeas application and not a state habeas application. So to the extent that this court has some unpublished opinions on that point, it may be appropriate to reconsider whether a prisoner needs to protect his rights in that way. And this would be a situation quite like Pace versus DiGuglielmo. In Pace, the issue essentially was that a prisoner had filed a state habeas application, but of course, statutory tolling under 2244D2 is only available if the state habeas application is properly filed.
It's harder on this record to make such a consequential ruling just because I think you agree the file itself, it seems, didn't get back. He discharges. He's got a short period of time.
It did, yeah, that's right. And it didn't get back. That's right. I believe that the records were returned on March 4th, 2010,
right.
and his clock lapsed in the federal court February 24th, 2010. But I still think that he probably would have been able to file the protective petition precisely because it really is a skeletal document. All it needs to say is, I am still attempting to exhaust my federal law claims in state court, and I ask that the federal district court stay and abate these proceedings while I exhaust in the state court. And so he wouldn't have needed access to his file or to his records to file that type of a petition. And this would be a very different case if he had done that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
What if we disagree with the district court about extraordinary circumstances because of the abandonment? That Riggs doesn't really apply or perhaps doesn't follow Maples, you know, what does the extraordinary circumstances trump the last second opportunity to file the protective one, or do you still can the state still argue that he should have filed a protective one even in light of the extraordinary circumstances of abandonment?
I still think that we would win, and for the reasons suggested by Judge Higginson, this is a disjunctive test in which all of the elements have to be satisfied. And so even if this were a case of abandonment, he would still have to show reasonable diligence. And as I've said, if he was abandoned by the lawyer that he hired to represent him on his state habeas application, that would in no way prevent him from representing himself in the federal habeas court.
Except he didn't have the file still.
Right, but he still would have been able to file the protective petition, as I've discussed. And some of the fire drill here might be attributable to his own behavior, insofar as Chief Judge Jackson suggested, he waited 7 months and then fired his lawyer 13 days before his clock was about to run out.
Remind me what the factual record is on, was it misrepresented to him that it actually had been filed, and so he had to do some time to check that out?
It's actually not so clear on that, Your Honor. It is suggested that is true in the blue brief, but a lot of the record citations don't support that assertion. So they point, for example, to the affidavit by Ms. Cortez, Palacios' wife, which you'll find on page 1018 and 1019 of the Record on Appeal. But that affidavit doesn't say anything about McMaine's telling Cortez that the state habeas application had been filed. And indeed, my friend in opposition in this court filed a motion to, I think, clarify the record on that point, and this court not surprisingly denied that motion insofar as this is not a court that sits to take evidence. And
so, lack of clarity on that point, though, as well as the record returning later than knowing the writ, my difficulty, if the district judge tomorrow were to deny the Rule 59, and it comes back to us, because of that lack of clarity, what's the standard of review that we would, is it de novo because of the legal error, or is it abuse of discretion because of that tag-on paragraph about, well, he could have filed it anyway?
Well, I think that the overall question on equitable tolling is going to be abuse of discretion, but I think that actually it's a third option that you didn't mention, and that would be that it would be you would review for clear error on the findings of fact by the district court.
And the salient finding, because he made none about deceit. What's the finding you
made? Oh, no, I believe that the district court did make findings to that effect, Your Honor. I believe it was in District Judge Ramos's response to the objections. I believe that the district court did find that there was that the record did not show that there was deceit, and in any event that Palacios didn't rely on it. And so if this court looks at the record and is...
So you say it's abusive, sorry, I'm interrupting, your time's running, abusive discretion as to legal issues, therefore de novo. Let's say he made a mistake on Riggs, we'd still be reaching the issue that wasn't squarely reached, reasonable diligence, and as to that, their findings of fact, we'd have to find would be clear error?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And the reason for that, I think, is that the district...
It would get cleared up if there were a little more development.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor, and although I don't spend a lot of time in the federal district courts, I've enjoyed my time there, and I would be happy to do what we can to bring this case to
Well, just the larger issues, you know, are immensely consequential.
Absolutely.
We do have lawyers reaching impasses
right.
with prisoners for the reasons stated.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that, may I respond? I do think that the finding here, everything that has to do with whether he relied on a misrepresentation depends on a finding of fact that there was any misrepresentation by the lawyer McMaines. And I submit that if you look at the district court's September 20th, 2011 order, you'll see that she said that there actually was no such misrepresentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, you know, he's asking you for forgiveness and to excuse his delay. And this is a Harvard law graduate. And he's asking you not to excuse the delay on my client who is below average intelligence. He was not even mainstreamed in school. The man never graduated with a diploma. And you ask him, well, why did he delay those 2 weeks? He says, sir, he writes as late as January and says, sir, my wife says that you told her you had filed. And then says, please, sir, I need my, finally he says, please, ASAP, send it to me, you know.
Yes. No, and we appreciate, I know I appreciate the promptness of your reply, but Mr. Sullivan has exercised a duty we would do anyway. We would have to discover it. And he's been quite nuanced in considering your client's case and suggesting there's some openness. So I would prefer you to get to the legal issues we raised, and particularly whether or not the district court made findings of fact
yes.
that would foreclose relief just on lack of diligence.
Your Honor, these were her findings of fact. Neville Gonzalez-Ramos, the evidence did not firmly establish that McMaines made false representations of fact. Well, you know, that's the same standard that the 11th Circuit said, and yep. it was struck down by Holland. They used the wrong test, the wrong standard. They used the standard that the 11th Circuit used,
yep,
that you have to go by fraud.
The point I'm making is assume you're right legally. Assume there was an extraordinary intervening event. This isn't garden variety neglect. This is true abandonment.
Yes.
Awful. But even if it is, your client slept on his rights. That's the concern we have.
How?
What's your answer to that?
But the Holland didn't find that, Holland v. Florida didn't find that Holland right. had slept on his rights.
What about his answer to that, which is that in Holland, the attorney would not get off the case, and therefore no hybrid representation could occur.
And this attorney would not ever answer my client, would never return the documents. You know, the magistrate said in her findings, well, you know, you could have filed your own pro se state habeas and then amended later. There's no such thing. A layman doesn't know that you can amend.
But counsel, I thought that in Holland, the petitioner there actually filed his own pro se petition the very day he realized that the deadline had expired. Your client, as I appreciate it, was aware all along of the deadline and, in fact, continued to advise Mr. McMaines of the deadline.
He had 2 weeks. He said, return my documents ASAP. The
which
attorney
is, which is acknowledgement, which is acknowledgement that he knew the deadline well before the deadline passed.
And look at your record. McMaines doesn't return anything because he didn't have the money to give back to my client. He doesn't return anything till March, after March 4th, well after the February 25th deadline. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I understand, but do you understand my point that I'm talking. Do you understand my point, counsel, that I see a significant distinction between the case here and the Holland case that you rely on so significantly?
In a
very important factual distinction is all I'm asking you.
Holland, Mr. Palacios had the same reaction that Holland did, and Holland was not struck down. The court says you don't need maximum feasible diligence, just reasonable diligence. That's what the 11th Circuit was saying, exactly what you're asking me. That's exactly what the 11th Circuit told him. You did not use utmost feasible diligence, and the Holland court said that is not the standard.
Our case is the Melanson, if I'm pronouncing it right, and Coleman.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
You recall, I believe they were in the briefs, Melanson and Coleman, the cases that said the elapsed amount of time. You're familiar with those cases?
But those cases came before Holland.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask.
Yes.
Your position is that line of case law has been abrogated.
That's right. It's out. And in case Ms. Jackson used a bunch of old cases, 94 cases on due diligence, I would like the court to point out. Now, I'm asking, you know, I don't know too much about the appellate procedures, neither did the magistrate. Apparently the magistrate, if you look at her transcript, she says, well, I don't know whether what he has filed, this is on the jurisdiction issue, I don't know whether he's filed a 59 or a Rule 60 motion. She says that on the record. Okay, Rule 60 motion allows her, according to the 62.1, to defer to the Court of Appeals before making a decision. That's all I'm saying. Apparently, she was not aware of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure number 4. I'm asking you, the magistrate made a lot of mistakes, and so did the district judge, not filing that answer. By the way, you know, Judge Garza, when he signed my certificate of appealability, the record was incomplete, and neither he nor I knew that the record was incomplete. The district court, and I have noticed him as a person of interest, never bothered ever supplementing to you the record. They last submitted the record in 2011, and yet they keep accepting motions and everything and never supplement this court.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.